mountain, we might venture a guess that we are looking at another old story of a volcano. And with this as our hypothesis, we should be able to puzzle out the details in Hesiod's narrative. Instead of dismissing the account because we wouldn't have told the story that way, we may start by asking if there is anything in it that suggests the story has any connection at all with reality. This approach draws our attention to Hesiod's distinction between the scene at night and that during the day. At a distance, a fire typically shows itself as smoke by day and as flame at night. As we see from Exodus, with its alternating pillars of smoke and fire from chapter 8, even God stays with this rule. So the distinction between nighttime and daytime appearances makes perfect sense if the story of Prometheus is an account of a fire, hardly unlikely considering his function in Greek myth. The regrowth of the bloody liver by night may then be an image suggesting the startling and obvious redness of the fire when surrounded by darkness. Opaque though Hesiod's story seems, the conclusion that it indeed concerns a volcano is strengthened by volcano myths from around the world. Typically, they involve giants, especially with one eye like Cyclops, flying stones, battles, loud noises, overwhelming darkness, lightning, mountaintops, the discovery of fire, three typical colors, black, red, and white, and a lot of bizarre but consistent imagery, including hair, red, snaky, etc. We explored numerous geological parallels to the noises, darkness, lightning, and so forth in Chapter 8. But eagles? If you find it difficult to see a story about a fire or volcano in a story about an eagle, try visualizing the scene. The long-winged eagle would serve nicely as an image for the volcano's ash cloud spreading across the sky. This may seem far-fetched to us, but we must remember how common it has been for people to relate major weather systems to the beating wings of giant birds. The thunderbird in America is viewed thus, for example. Indeed, Prometheus's eagle is eventually reinterpreted in the Caucasus as the source of storms, which it causes by the beating of its wings. Has anyone seeing an eruption ever thought it was really a giant eagle feeding on a liver? We think we can safely doubt this, but the very question obscures the immense difficulty confronting the person who sees a volcano erupt for the first time and lacks any grasp of tectonic theory. A more useful question is, how did the first human beings talk about a volcano the first time they saw one erupt? The answer is that once they could talk, they probably wove together a group of images that created a coherent whole, which is what we do. This is easiest to see if you try the alternatives. But what are the alternatives? We can't even say that the mountain exploded, not without such a concept and word. If we say that rocks flew about, we have violated the willfulness principle. Something has to have thrown the rocks. We can say that a giant on the mountain flung rocks about, but that is pretty much what people did say, and now we find it all but unintelligible. The following is from a later version of the Prometheus story. You, the Prometheus figure, aim at the bird with a stone and try to throw it at her, but your chains wind more tightly, and your pillar sinks deeper into the earth. From Colarusso, 2002. Human cognition, moreover, simply won't allow major events to be reported without being put into an overall worldview, or minor events either. Remember the bird and the orange in Chapter 2. Physicists don't just seek a unified field theory, they demand it. So it's not as if the story could have been told as a series of disconnected images. It's difficult even to make up an example of disconnected images, and when we do, it's annoying and seems deliberately idiotic or giddily humorous. Apparently, Zeus attached a giant to a mountain. Then it was as if a huge eagle came by every day and started to devour a slab of dark, glistening liver. And at night, it looked as though an immense fire-red abalone lay there in the giant's lap, heaving and growling. Then one day the giant, or maybe even Zeus, started to throw stones and fling dust up into the air, and there was as much lightning as in 20 rainstorms put together, but no rain. At the same time, it was as if 1,000 demented hellhounds began to bay all at once. The noise was so great. And when those of us who survived came back later, the giant was gone and the river had dried up. Try working that into your worldview. If you find this example even more preposterous than Hesiod, then you have grasped the difficulty. Besides being incoherent, such a version leaves out everything important, why the events happened and what they mean. Yet coherence and meaningfulness are central to human thought patterns. Sir Frederick Bartlett's classic experiments in having people retell later a simple but foreign folk tale showed that, where the silence principle had caused the original narrators and hearers to take much for granted that is not expressed, so the narration seems jerky. The subject, acting almost always unwittingly, supplies connecting links. Ideally, of course, you would link your volcano story to a context that makes it a unique event, unless, that is, you want to worry constantly about the local mountains exploding. And indeed, our ancestors, when a mountain did explode, had no way of knowing that this doesn't actually happen very often. Note the causal links in the following narrative. Up to that time, Pato, Mount Adams, had had a high head. Wyeast, Mount Hood, hit her from the east side and knocked her head off. Today, on the north side of Pato, there is a pile of fine rocks about half a mile long. These rocks were once Pato's head. Pato became difficult. The Great Spirit was watching. He saw all that happened. At last he said, "I shall make a new head for Pato. Then she will not be so mean." So he sent down a big white eagle with his son, a red eagle, riding on his right shoulder. He put the two eagles on top of Pato to be her head. From Clark, 1953. And here we are back to eagles in volcano stories. Why eagles? Well, to paraphrase George Lee Mallory, because they're there. They are animate, and they hang around mountains. In fact, the folklorist who collected this story, Ella Clark, points out that eagles nest in the caves atop Mount Adams. So, if you need an image involving something animate and powerful at the top of a mountain, the eagle is surely your first choice. No abalones need apply. And suddenly, the story of Prometheus becomes a bit less bizarre. It is also clear that high volcanoes can have both red and white, fire and snow, or ash at their tops. But another story collected by Clark gives the eagle two children, which sit at either side of White Eagle's topmost crown. Here, the two young eagles are clearly the two points that rise slightly lower on either side of the top of Mount Adams. This version could represent a later reinterpretation. This is no more surprising than the town of Eagle Rock, California, being named for an outcropping that's supposed to resemble an eagle, though it's hard to tell whether it's the wings or the beak that people see in the outcrop. Now, if we think we know what Prometheus is, how do we test our hypothesis? We began years ago by looking for volcanoes where the Greeks themselves located Prometheus. Although Hesiod says nothing about location, Aeschylus puts him among the Scythians, who lived in the steppes north of the Caucasus and Black Sea. More specifically, the Argonauts encounter Prometheus at the east end of the Black Sea. And then, as they traveled on, a recess of the sea appeared, and the crags of the Caucasus Mountains sprang up, steep ones, where his limbs bound to the mighty rocks with unbreakable bonds. Prometheus fed with his liver the swift and ever-returning eagle. At dusk, they saw it high above the ship, with a shrill whistling, flying near the clouds. But nonetheless, it shook all the sails with its wings as it passed, for it did not have the form of a bird in the air, but shook its swift wings to and fro like polished oars. Not long after, they heard the much groaning voice of Prometheus, having his liver ripped out, and the air resounded with his cries. From Apollonius Rhodius, Argonautica. Here the eagle is enjoying supper rather than lunch on Prometheus's liver, and there is a great deal of noise from the victim's screams and groans. We also see that the story maintained itself in its essentials for many years within the Greek world, which favors the theory that it is connected to an actual site that people could point to. And indeed, there is a spectacular volcano, Mount Elbrus, over 18,000 feet high in the Caucasus at the east end of the Black Sea. Depending on where you draw the boundary line, it is either Europe's highest mountain or a nondescript hump in Asia, where there is at least one pass that high, the Karakoram. Furthermore, we find that the Prometheus myth is alive and well among the local Caucasian inhabitants, a fact that has long been known to scholars in the field. Legend tells us that a giant has been chained to the summit of snowy Elbrus for committing sins of some sort. When he awakens, he asks his guards, "Are rushes still growing on the earth? Are lambs still being born?" His pitiless guards respond, "Yes, rushes still grow, and lambs are still born." Then the giant grows furious. He breaks his shackles, and the earth then shakes as he moves. His chains give off lightning and a roar like thunder. His heavy breathing is the blizzard's gust. His moaning is the underground drone of a raging river, and his tears are its waters as it emerges into daylight at the foot of Elbrus. From Colarusso, 2002. Here, the only clear tectonic activity is an earthquake, and everything else attributed to the giant is simply weather. The myth, in other words, has adapted to the fact that Elbrus doesn't erupt all that often, but earthquakes are common in the region. Also, it won't do to argue that we have lost the eagle with a taste for giant's flesh, because in other versions, the eagle has maintained its importance for millennia. For example, in one of the great Caucasian sagas, the Nart hero Nasran rides to the blessed peak, Elbrus, to fetch fire from the giant Pakwa. Suddenly, he heard a voice like thunder resounding from the top of the mountain, as though someone were talking, and to him it seemed that the sky had split into two. It was Pakwa saying, "You little man, what have you come here to do? If you do not go back, you shall perish at my hands. You stand in God's place, and they say you are benevolent," said Nasran, trying to flatter Pakwa. "If that is so, then why have you taken fire away from the Narts, and why have you sent bitter cold so that we will freeze to death?" "If you want to return home, then go. Don't make my head hurt. If you continue in this way, I shall chain you to the highest peak. I shall hold you prisoner until you die." Pakwa bound Nasran's body all around in chains, and then fastened him to the summit of the blessed peak. Pakwa had an enormous eagle. This ravening beast was greedy for human flesh. The wicked Pakwa was enraged and set loose his huge eagle. The eagle's wingspan was so great that it could not fly down in the valleys. When it flew, it blocked out the sun so that the earth became enshrouded in darkness. It flew up and landed on the chest of the mighty Nart Nazran. It tore open his chest with its powerful beak. It drank his heart's blood and pecked at his lungs with its razor-sharp beak. Chained to the blessed peak, Nazran roared and moaned, his cries being carried by the winds to the Narts. The Narts try to rescue Nazran, but fail. Finally, Nart Pataraz offers to go and bring back both Fire and Nazran. From the foothills, he cries to Pakwa, "Call off your giant bloodthirsty eagle from Nazran, and send it down here from the mountain!" Then the sky grew very dark. This meant that the great eagle had arisen from the mountain. The wings of the wicked bird brought darkness everywhere. The horse on which Pataraz sat grew frightened. Pataraz laid another lash on Little Black. Thereupon Little Black gave a snort and leaped up into the sky, and they began to fight with the monstrous eagle. It was a great ordeal for Pataraz to fight with the wicked bird, but despite this, he was finally able to shoot an arrow through one of its wings. When he did this, it was as though someone had opened a window. The sun shone through the eagle's wing, and it became light once more. In this way, Nart Pataraz vanquished Pakwa's eagle. Pataraz then fights off one monster after another, who shake the ground as they fall, until Pakwa flees, leaving Pataraz free to unchain and rescue Nazran. If the eagle started out as an image for the ash cloud, it really did bring darkness everywhere, as we saw in Chapter 8. And here it helps to think back on why Prometheus is the particular mythological figure who brings fire. It is not just because fire is associated with certain mountaintops. It is also because eruptions cause static electricity, that is, lightning, another real-life bringer of fire we saw in Chapter 8. Throughout the world, fire is often thought to have made its way into wood by lightning strikes on trees. And who is Prometheus's enemy? Indeed, the one who attached him to the mountain. Zeus, the wielder of thunderbolts. So the story has a kind of internal consistency, using the logic cross-check, that is largely lost on the modern reader. The modern Nart versions include virtually everything in Hesiod, the eagle, the chains, and the shaft. The liver has been transmuted into heart and or lungs. Ulrich points out that the local inhabitants insist that the existence of Amaran, another local name for this Prometheus figure, is not something one is expected to believe in, but something one can actually see. Actually see. And it is this mnemonic quality of the mountain that makes it possible for the stories to remain more or less intact, and that holds the fogging effect somewhat at bay. If you look at all the Prometheus stories, in fact, you find that it is only the imagery that is unusual. The events are hard-edged, actual events, and quite indisputable. There was once a fire attached to Elbrus. Eruptions do shut out the sun. Storms do occur in the vicinity of high mountains, and earthquakes are not uncommon in the local fault zone. Consider another major Promethean tradition, that of the Georgian epic hero Amirani, treated splendidly at length, both analytically and comparatively, by George Karakidze in 1986. Amirani is born in a torrent of red, being ripped prematurely from the belly of his mother, gold-haired Dali, a divine protectress of wild animals. God becomes his godfather and gives him superhuman strength, then hands him to a peasant to raise with his own two sons. The three boys amuse themselves, attacking everyone who passes by, until Amirani attacks a three-headed giant. As he cuts off each head, each exudes a worm that grows into a serpent, one white, one red, one black. Amirani kills the white and red ones, but the black one swallows him. In desperation, he cuts open its belly from inside and issues back into the world. He then attacks and massacres a fortress full of demons, but again he almost drowns, this time in the rising lake of their blood that he has shed. Suddenly, one wall of the black fort breaks, and the red lake pours out. Thus, he escapes. During an attempt to abduct the Demon King's daughter, the two foster brothers are killed, and although Amirani manages to slaughter the entire demon army, king and all, he is so distraught by his brother's deaths that he commits suicide. But the demon girl revives all three. Amirani now fares forth alone, encountering a half-dead giant whose leg falls on him, pinning him down. God sees his despair and grants him yet more strength, so he escapes again. But now there is none strong enough to oppose him as he lays waste to the world, except God himself. So he challenges God. Although the details of the contest vary, it always involves trying to pull out a pillar or post that God has rooted all the way through the earth and then some. It always ends with Amirani chained to the pillar and God shutting Amirani under a dome of rock like a cap. Amirani's winged hunting dog, Kursha, Black Ears, a puppy born of eagles, tries to lick away his master's chains, but whenever he almost succeeds, they renew themselves. This renewal is aided by human blacksmiths hammering ritually on their anvils on a particular day of the year, for fear the destructive Amirani will return. Again, there is little here that doesn't smack of volcanism, with a liberal sprinkling of willfulness, birth and rebirth by bloodily bursting forth, a red lake pent up in a fortress of black rock, a tremendous power and its kin dying, then starting up again, repeated laying waste to everything around, a still greater power doming rock over the nuisance, which is suddenly attended by a black winged creature, and finally blacksmiths. Compare this to Etna as Hephaestus's smithy. Karakidze struggles to account for the close resemblance between Greek Prometheus and the Georgian myth of Amirani, including the closely related Abkhaz, Sfan, Circassian, and other myths, some of which were written down 1,500 years ago. He suggests the Greeks and Caucasians must once have lived as neighbors, a fact deducible on several other grounds. Yet he is obliged to point out the many internal details, making it impossible to assume either that the Greeks took the myth from a Caucasian group or the Caucasians from the Greeks. Since the details are much too similar for chance, he understandably rejects independent invention. Yet he comments that it is almost as though the Greeks took the same basic story of one who challenged God and built their version around their cultural preoccupation with challenges between intellects, while the Caucasians built their story around their preoccupation with challenges of physical strength. He would have liked the two language groups to have had a common ancestor, but understands that they didn't, at least not recently enough to account for these stories. In the end, he finds no satisfying solution. Yet it takes only a tiny step to solve his dilemma, and that of Wilhelm in 1998, who fares no better with the problem. The Greeks and Caucasian speakers need only have watched the same spectacular eruption of Elbrus from their own vantage points, and each mythologized this challenge of the mountain to the sky above according to their own cultural patterns, starting from similar late Neolithic and or Bronze Age cultural stages and the cognitive principles by which myths develop. Recent dating of the eruptions of Elbrus offer a possible time frame for the original eruptions that led to the mountain's truculent reputation. Bogotnikov and his fellow geologists have tentatively distinguished three eruptive events of different ages for Elbrus: 5500 to 5200 BC, 3300 to 2600 BC, and AD 0 to 100. The last of these postdates the earliest accounts, so it is the middle eruptive sequence, also the longest and most complex, that seems most likely to have inspired the story. These geological findings strengthen the hypothesis that the story of Loki is a changed later version of the same myth as Prometheus, since for that to be true, the events would have to have antedated the breakup of the Indo-European tribes, whom archaeologists and linguists widely reconstruct as still living more or less together near the Caucasus around 3000 BC. In fact, Loki and Prometheus share enough peculiar features that we can now puzzle out Loki's nature, long since obscured by the silence principle. 1. Both are of the race of giants, or the equivalent. Technically, in Greek myth, the giants form one brood of children of the Titans, the gods another, and in the squabbles, the giants side with the Titans against the gods. Prometheus is the son of Titans, and classed as a Titan. Yet, 2, he lives with and generally sides with the gods, just as Loki, who is of the race of giants, generally lives with and works for the gods. 3, both are noted for their clever craftsmanship, Prometheus using especially clay, and Loki repeatedly instigating the dwarves to forge metal treasures. 4. Both betray the gods they live with, Prometheus by stealing fire from the gods for mankind, and Loki by a whole series of pranks, such as destroying the beautiful golden hair of the grain goddess Sif. That is, 5. Both Loki and Prometheus are sometimes good and helpful, like gods, and sometimes evil and destructive, like giants, as in Chapter 7. 6. Loki and Prometheus suffer the same punishment, being chained to rocks while being tortured daily in punishment for their misdeeds. 7. The writhings of Loki and of the Caucasian Prometheus figures cause earthquakes. Now, let's recast the problem like a Sphinx's riddle. What active, willful element is the most ambiguous, being among the most useful to humans, that is, good, and yet among the most destructive, that is, evil? Data. It is used in metalworking and with clay. Can destroy an entire crop of ripe grain in no time, and sometimes appears on mountainsides in conjunction with earthquakes. Surely the answer is fire. Loki, like Prometheus, must have once been some kind of fire deity. When Loki accompanies Thor to visit the giant Utgard-Loki, who lives in a sort of antimatter world, and is nudged out in an eating contest by the giant's henchman Logi, who ate not just the meat, but the bones and the trencher, too, it eventually turns out that the man called Logi was Wildfire, and he burned the trencher as quickly as he did the chopped meat. Domestic fire was paired to fight against Wildfire and just barely lost. So Prometheus, the god of fire chained to a mountain, is fire-spitting Elbrus. And now we must get down to the heart, or liver, of our argument. First, myths and folklore typically make no distinction between observations and interpretations. Once an event is interpreted, the observations and interpretations are jumbled together by the rationalization syndrome and movie construct. Second, the original story had to have been told by people who reasoned that, if something happened, it had to be willed. But then it was transmitted down through history to people who no longer believed that, people for whom things could happen without a conscious will being involved. But those people, looking at the original story, could only conclude that the actor in the story must have been something animate by their new standard, a person, or perhaps a god or a giant. So by the time of Aeschylus, Prometheus turns up as a person in a play, chatting up various figures who come around to see him, and we, in modern times, have typically taken our cue from Aeschylus. The fogging effect has rolled in. A real event can be transformed by explanations that force it into a current worldview, and this worldview, once it is abandoned, leaves the hearer of the myth with nothing but a beguiling story. Beguiling because the story wouldn't even survive if it lacked interest. Among the Romantics, Prometheus became a symbol of hubris, as in Mary Shelley's famous title, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, because he defied Zeus. But thousands of years ago, he was certainly a mountain that distinguished itself by especially dramatic tectonic activity. Chapter 18, Fire-Breathing Dragons. The Invisible Worm That Flies in the Night in the Howling Storm. William Blake, The Sick Rose. Songs of Innocence and of Experience. We English speakers all know that dragons, or at least Germanic ones, look like gigantic scaly salamanders, that they have bad breath, belch fire, guard treasure inside dank caverns, and can fly. Recent fiction, from The Hobbit to Shrek, trades on this knowledge. Not to mention Gary Larson's cartoon of two dragons in bed, one shrinking from the other, saying, "It's your breath. It's fresh and minty." The two most famous sources for the attributes are the early Germanic literary works Beowulf and the Volsunga saga. First, let's examine Beowulf. After slaying two bog monsters, the old English epic recounts, Beowulf reigned prosperously for 50 winters, until a dragon began in the dark nights to rule, one that watched over its hoard in a heap in the steep stone mound. A last lone survivor of some ancient clan had hidden the family riches in a great stone burial mound on a coastal headland, and after the man died, a dragon, which flies in the night enveloped in fire, sniffed out the treasure for his own and guarded it for 300 winters. Then a nameless bondsman, hiding from his angered master, found entry into the mound and stole a golden cup to win back his lord's favor. The great worm, serpent or dragon, awoke to find himself robbed. Inside and out he hunted for his missing precious and its taker, but in vain. The hoard watcher waited with impatience till evening. Then the barrow's warden was wrathful. Then would he, hostile with flame, requite for his dear drinking bowl. Day departed as the worm wished, nor would he long abide in his lair, but with burning fared forth. The fire dragon flashed out across the fields, vomiting fire, raising the countryside, terrorizing the people, and returning at daybreak to his secret hoard. As Beowulf's own favorite hall burned down, the hero vowed vengeance. The aging king ordered an iron shield made, since wooden ones would be useless. Then he addressed his men, saying that he would not take a sword to this battle if he knew how else to grapple with the creature, but that he expected much heat and venom, and so had armed them all with shields and corselets. They could watch in safety from a nearby hill while he attempted to settle accounts and win the hoard. Nearing the mound of stones, he saw a stone arch, from which issued a stream of flame, so hot he could not approach closer. So he cried a battle challenge. The gold garter responded. From the stones first came a blast of evil breath, then more flame, as Beowulf wielded his great sword from behind his shield. But the shield protected him for a lesser while than his mind wished, and his sword blunted faster on the dragon's bones and bit less strongly than its ruler had need of. As he vainly fought the dragon's flames, his kinsman Wiglaf ran to his aid with shield and sword. In ire, the worm belched flames anew, incinerating Wiglaf's linden shield, so the youth had to take refuge under his lord's iron one. Beowulf struck once more, but his sword Nagling snapped in two, and the worm flashed forth a third time, wrapping his fangs around Beowulf's neck, scorching him horribly, and burning Wiglaf's hand. Ignoring the dragon's head, Wiglaf struck a little lower, so that the sword dived down, hostile and ornate, and the fire began to die away afterwards. Beowulf roused himself, pulled his dagger, and plunged a final blow deep down into the dragon's middle. The battle over, Beowulf sat down, knowing himself mortally wounded, and surveyed the stone entrance. He asked Wiglaf to enter the dead dragon's lair and bring out some of its treasure, so that, seeing it, he might die content. Wiglaf obeyed. Inside he found piles of gold and jewels, empty vessels, rusty helmets, arm rings, and bright golden hangings. But not of the worm was there any sign. For him, the blade's edge had destroyed. Wiglaf chose out many things and hurried back to his lord. Beowulf looked at them, grateful that his death had purchased such wealth, and asked that, after the funeral pyre, his people pile a high mound on the headland to be called Beowulf's Hill, so that passing seafarers might see it and remember him always. Such is Beowulf's fight with a dragon, who indeed guards gold inside a dark mound, flies, and spews fire and bad breath. We just don't know what the beast itself looked like. To understand what is behind this story, we must begin with the stripping procedure from Chapter 4, removing explanations, or newsreel, and singling out the observations, the component snapshots. 1. Someone steals a cup from an old barrow. 2. Fire erupts from the barrow and spreads. 3. Near the stone entrance, our hero stabs blindly at the source of flames while shielding himself ineffectively from them. 4. It smells bad. 5. People stab deeper and eventually the flame goes out. 6. Inside the barrow is treasure, but no trace of a dragon's body. People do steal from tombs. Tombs can smell bad and can contain valuables. Fire, once started, can spread as wildfire, and loss of one's home may be long remembered. Fires go out when the fuel is exhausted or suppressed. So far, reality. We don't know the dragon's appearance, however, because while it's alive, all you can see is flame, and once the fire is out, there is nothing left. No one ever saw it. They saw only flames and smelled a bad smell. The dragon must be a figment of explanation. A willer, invisible except for its fiery exhalations, postulated to explain the presence of that barrier of flames. If you can't get to the treasure, something must be willfully, even malevolently, guarding it. So when the bondsman first got in, the guardian must have been snoozing. The storykeepers are so sure that a tangible creature must have existed that 400 lines later, the poet hedges his bets by explaining the lack of dragon bones a second and contradictory way. When the frightened retainers returned, he says, they pillaged the mound, shoved the dragon, the worm, over the cliff, let the wave take, the flood enfold, the guardian of the treasure. Then they carried the dead king to his pyre. So whence the flames? We learn more of them from the Icelandic Grettisaga, which follows the career of Grettir, a blustery Icelandic outlaw who reputedly lived in the 11th century. At one point, Grettir sojourned with a Norwegian farmer named Thorfinn, becoming friends with his tenant, Auden. It happened late one evening that he saw a huge fire burst forth on the headland below Auden's farm. Grettir asked what was happening, but Auden said there was no need for him to worry about it. "If such a thing were seen in my country," said Grettir, "it would be said that the flame came from a buried treasure." The farmer said, "The owner of this fire, I think, is one whom it is better not to inquire about." "Still, I wish to know," said Grettir. "There on the headland stands a grave mound," said Auden, "and Thorfinn's father, Kar the Old, was buried in it." Grettir said he had done well to tell him. "I shall be back tomorrow, and then you must have digging tools ready for me." Early the next morning, the digging tools were ready, and the farmer went with him to the mound. Grettir began to break open the mound, and worked hard without stopping until he reached the rafters. Then he tore them up. Auden did his best to discourage him from entering the mound. Grettir told him to watch the rope, "for I am going to find out what inhabits the barrow." Then Grettir went into the mound. Inside it was dark, and the air not very sweet. He groped about to find out how things were arranged. He came upon some horse bones, then he knocked against the carved back post of a chair, and he could feel someone sitting in it. A great treasure of gold and silver was gathered together there. Grettir took all the treasure and carried it towards the rope, but as he was making his way through the barrow, he was seized fast by someone. He let go of the treasure and turned to attack, and they set on each other mercilessly, so that everything in their way was thrown out of place. The mound dweller attacked vigorously, and for a while Grettir had to give way. But finally he realized this was not a good time to spare himself. Then they both fought desperately. But in the end, the mound dweller fell backwards, and there was a great crash. Then Auden ran away from the rope, thinking that Grettir must be dead. Grettir drew his sword, named Jokul's Gift, and struck with it at the mound dweller's neck, so that it cut off his head. He placed the head against Kar's buttocks and brought the treasure over to the rope. He found Auden gone, so he had to climb up the rope hand over hand. He had tied the treasure to the rope, and he hauled it up afterwards. Grettir, who was very stiff after his dealing with Kar, made his way back to Thorfinn's farm, carrying the treasure. From Fox and Paulson, 1974. "So here we have a burial mound spouting flame, just as in Beowulf, and learn that Grettir immediately associates that pairing with treasure. We also find stinky air and an unseen malevolent guardian, whom Grettir takes to be the spirit and body of the man buried there. We learn this when Grettir decapitates the mound dweller, then sets the head against Kar's buttocks. Removing the head and setting it by the feet or thigh is an age-old prophylactic against the deceased coming back, represented already on an Egyptian battle monument of 3100 BC. The fight itself is best understood knowing that every valorous battle that Grettir claims he fought occurred when no one else could actually see what was going on, as when he single-handedly battled a giant under a waterfall. All Auden could observe was much crashing around inside a dark hole. Applying the stripping procedure, we find that someone breaks into an old burial mound and removes its treasure after being alerted to its existence by a sudden flame, as in Beowulf. Archaeology shows that Indo-European tribes from the late Stone Age into the Iron Age, and through the Viking period in Scandinavia, buried their important dead in a chamber over which they heaped a mound. Both Beowulf and Homer describe the purpose of mounds as reminding people of important ancestors and their exploits. Many such mounds have been excavated, and their chambers, if intact, can be so well sealed that perishables like textiles and carved wood often survive. The flesh, that of the owner and of the horses often buried alongside, has generally rotted. Decomposition of so much flesh in an anoxic environment, like a sealed tomb, creates a lot of poisonous-smelling methane, or marsh gas, captive in the tomb until the seal is broken. Chinese grave robbers in the Yangtze region often learned this the hard way. Elite tombs there of the late 1st millennium BC are often so effectively sealed that when first broken open, a wave of highly inflammable marsh gas rushes out, which has occasionally incinerated the nocturnal robber unwise enough to carry a torch or lamp, giving them the nickname fire pit graves. But how else could one explore inside an enclosed tomb before the days of electricity, if not with a torch or lamp? In 1972, at Mawangdui, when Tomb 1 was opened, a spark from a metal spade ignited methane held within. Furthermore, Wang Chung, AD 27 to about 100, records an instance in which flame shot out of a burial chamber and burned to death several hundred persons nearby. So the source of the fire that alerted both Grettir and Beowulf is the mound dweller, but in gaseous form. Once the methane starts to escape from digging or internal collapse, one needs only a spark from lightning, torches, or a digger's iron tool striking rocks. Hence, the mound and its buried treasure are indeed protected by something that smells bad and tends to burst into flame. We need only add willfulness and then try to deduce the form of the creature with that evil will. What sorts of creatures do we know that slither in and out of rock piles? Snakes, salamanders, lizards, and the like, all of them long, thin, and scaly, as the confined habitat demands. Ergo, by analogy, fire dragons probably look snaky too. Old English worm simply means snake. We now have the right camera angle to decode Fafnir, the other great Germanic dragon, whose killing is recounted in Snorri Sturluson's Poetic Diction, and at greater length in the Volsunga saga, as follows. The father of Oter, Fafnir, and Regin acquired an enormous heap of accursed gold as recompense for Oter's death, but Fafnir murdered his father for the gold and cheated Regin of his share of the inheritance. Fafnir then grew so malevolent that he went off to live in the wilds and allowed none but himself to have any pleasure in the riches. And later on he turned into a terrible dragon. And now, says Regin to the young and gullible hero Sigurd, he lies on the treasure. Sigurd promises he will attack the dragon if Regin, a smith, forges him a first-rate sword for the purpose, which Regin eventually does. Now Sigurd and Regin rode up to the moors, to the track along which Fafnir used to crawl when he went to drink. Newsreel from Snapshot: all living animals must drink, therefore so must the dragon, but he will have to crawl to the stream from the mound. Sigurd digs pits along the crawlway and settles into one to wait, while Regin runs away in terror. And when the dragon crawled to the water, he breathed out poison all over the path ahead, but Sigurd was neither frightened nor dismayed by the noise. And when the dragon crawled across the pit, Sigurd thrust in the sword under the left shoulder, and it sunk in up to the hilt. The dragon, after a leisurely conversation and some ill wishes, dies. Translation: a rush of noxious marsh gas comes out of the burial hill after Sigurd, like Beowulf, starts piercing the ground. This abates. Our earliest written forms of this tale date to the 13th century, but we have earlier pictorial sources, as the next scene proves. In the Volsunga saga, Regin soon returns from safety, like Beowulf's retainers, but, shifting to a quite different type of tale, he asks Sigurd to roast the dragon's heart for him to eat. By analogy to known creatures, the dragon presumably has a head and a heart. Sigurd went and roasted it on a spit, and when the juice sputtered out, he touched it with his finger to see whether it was done. He jerked his finger to his mouth, and when the blood from the dragon's heart touched his tongue, he could understand the language of birds. He hears the nearby birds saying Regin means to kill him, so he kills Regin first. These singular details are carved into a rock at Ramsund, Sweden. We see a bird in a tree watching a man with his thumb in his mouth, who holds a heart-shaped object on a stick over something flame-like. This scene is surrounded by a ribbon with a couple of heads, no legs, maybe some flames, which a man stabs from below with a sword. This can only represent Sigurd slaying a Fafnir. But again, no one knew what a dragon looked like, just a nondescript ribbon with snouts. We tend to assume the word dragon always refers to the same thing, but not all dragons are the same. Chinese dragons were beneficent rainbringers, playfully swallowing up and spitting out their celestial moon pearl as they cavorted in the sky. No dank and smelly caverns for them. Other dragons seem to represent rainbows. Then there was the cosmic dragon of early Mesopotamia and Greece, the dragon that ruled the center of the world, the celestial pole, until a new deity fought it for ownership and won. In Chapter 16, we saw that when the North Celestial Pole, crucial for orientation and navigation, shifted out of Draco or Dragon, the long snaky constellation between the two dippers, toward the Little Dipper, where our Polaris is today, some willful force had killed the dragon or driven it off. Why would it give way unless it had been bested in a fight and appropriated the navel of the world for himself, as Apollo did to Pytho, or Python, on Parnassus? The details are what provide the clues to the various origins. Generic dragons form the topic of several academic books, for example by Joseph Fontenrose, Paul Newman, Calvert Watkins, and David Jones. The very name dragon attracts the beasts together. Some of these treatises, however, begin from camera angles that obscure the different origins instead of elucidating them. Thus, the motif approach to myth and folklore pioneered by Antti Aarne, Stith Thompson, and Vladimir Propp purposely reduces all narratives to basic plots, the skeletons of storytelling, Roger Shank's scripts. Such work produces an index for locating similar, simple events and sequences, but obliterates unique and telltale relations to the real world. Fontenrose, for instance, reduces the story of Pytho and Apollo, and much else, to 1. The enemy, or dragon, was of divine origin. 2. The enemy had a distinctive habitation. He lived in a cave, hut, or tree. 3. The enemy had extraordinary appearance and properties. 4. The enemy was vicious and greedy. And so on until 7. The champion fought the enemy, and 9. The enemy was finally destroyed. But these are so general as to constitute narrative techniques. Without contrasts, enemy versus champion, divine versus mortal, gigantic versus normal, there is no story, nothing to resolve. What is the champion to do with the enemy if not fight him? Sit down at a negotiating table? Fill out environmental impact reports? Watkins compresses the themes even further to Hero Slays Serpent, a base useful for his examination of linguistic formulae for recounting dragon slaying, but one that obscures the fact that some slain dragons originated as methane, others as lava, rain clouds, or stars. It's not that differences stem from elaborations of a single theme, but that scholars have reduced different events until everything sounds similar. Dragons indeed are typically transient, slayable nuisances, but there the similarity stops. With all differences obscured, his question, "Why does the hero slay the serpent?" leads nowhere except back to the basic human fantasies that empower fiction. We enjoy identifying with heroic success. Robert Blust also reduces dragons to a series of typical traits, which he organizes from a worldwide survey. But since, like us, he believes such ideas arose through processes of reasoning which do not differ essentially from those underlying modern scientific explanations, his meticulous treatment makes it fairly easy to extract those dragons not originating from rainbows, his principal theory. Not everyone is seeking origins, of course. The point is that motifs won't show them to you, and in fact will blur together stories of quite different function that happen to share some surface forms. Not all dragons had the same parentage. St. George's dragon makes the point well. The original George lived in the eastern Mediterranean, apparently tortured and beheaded by the Romans around AD 300, but his dragon does not make its first definite appearance until the 12th century. This dragon, for all that it fits Fontenrose's themes, was born from neither decomposing bodies nor celestial events, but from a mistake, an analogical reinterpretation of an image. Cornelia Hulst, in researching St. George, came upon the key camera angle. For over a millennium, the often illiterate Christians used visual images to teach and remember aspects of their faith. In these images, sin or evil was encoded as a serpent, as in the Garden of Eden, while the church was represented as a chaste virgin, the bride of Christ. The word ecclesia, church, was feminine. Hence, as Hulst put it, the early Eastern Orthodox representations of St. George showed him with a dragon under his feet and a crowned virgin at his side, a symbolical way of saying that he overcame sin in the service of the church. This image has an interesting and traceable genesis, according to Fox, 1983. The Roman emperors frequently had themselves portrayed mounted on horseback and lance in hand, spearing a prostrate figure. But in their case, although the attitude is very similar to that of St. George himself, their victim is not a dragon, but their defeated foe. Constantine, however, the emperor whose conversion early in the 4th century made the empire safe for Christianity, provided a significant exception, for Eusebius records that the first Christian emperor had himself depicted piercing with the labarum the serpent or dragon of paganism. It was a short step from there to the imagery surrounding George. But the Greeks, seeing this tableau, already knew from their inherited mythology that heroes like Perseus had rescued maidens like Andromeda by slaying serpents. What was allegorical thus came to be reinterpreted as actual, principle of metaphoric reality, as in the Snowball stories. St. George actually killed a real dragon or serpent by force of arms, just like Perseus. Is it an accident that the restructured St. George became particularly popular in England, a land with its own early history of dragon combats? Camera angle is crucial, and figuring out camera placement comes from observing, not obscuring, the details. Belief in dragons is perceived today as nearly universal, not because the belief is the same everywhere, but because we use the same word for a variety of beliefs with a scattering of surface resemblances. Apparently, the principle of attraction still lives, operating in modern times around words which pull to themselves such diverse creatures as Germanic gold-hoarding mound dwellers, Basuto waterfall-dwelling rainbow serpents, and the long, skinny Sumerian star constellation that held back the celestial flood until the next precession. Similarly, our word vampire attracts to itself anything anywhere that is thought to suck blood, from bloated corpses to Romanian princes to bats. Faute de mieux, we give them the same name, then, following the principle of metaphoric reality, turn around and believe the reference are all the same. Throughout this book, we have argued that myths were not intended as fiction in our sense, but as carriers of important information about real events and observations. We have also given much evidence that, contrary to prevailing belief today, this information can sometimes survive intact for thousands of years. But bombarded as myth is by silence, compression, restructuring, and so on, the conditions must be right for survival. In 1936, Lord Raglan published a very influential calculation of about 150 years maximum for how long an incident that is not recorded in writing can be remembered. After this, he claims, we are in a period of events which have been completely forgotten, and which is therefore available for the myths. These being ageless can be allotted to any period. We agree that the timescale gets lost, or at least compressed, and many details of events as well, but not that all events, or even all details, are lost, for reasons we have set forth throughout the book. Most particularly, we disagree with Raglan's very astutely argued stance that since history depends upon written chronology, the savage can have no history. And since interest in the past is induced solely by books, the savage can take no interest in the past. As with Crater Lake and the stars, a major and still present mnemonic can foster remembrance of clan history and celestial affairs for millennia. Our task is to decipher the contents of these precious time capsules. This is Beth Richmond for University Press Audiobooks. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is copyrighted in 2010 in the name of Redwood Audiobooks and is based on the book When They Severed Earth from Sky by Elizabeth Wayland Barber and Paul T. Barber, copyrighted in 2004 in the name of Princeton University Press. For a complete list of University Press audiobooks, please visit the website at www.universitypressaudiobooks.com.